So we are now recording the audio. So welcome all to tonight's presentation on typography. As I mentioned in the pre-meeting deck, there was a link in there to pick up the PDF of tonight's presentation. I will be showing that as well at the end of my presentation. I highly recommend if you are interested in this topic, pick up the deck because I've got a lot of slides to go through. So with that, I think I will go ahead and kick things off. Okay, so tonight's presentation is on typography, the art and science. So a bit of a purist note, I think that most of the information should be of interest to anybody who has something they're writing and they want other people to be able to understand what they've read or what they've written. But there will be some fascinating stuff, I think, that purists will care about. It's not all that interesting to people who are just dipping their toes into the pond of typography. So watch out for those green asterisks if you just want to tune out for them. That's fine. Some style notes going through the deck. Text in blue through most of the slides are going to be an example of an actual typeface. And most of the time, I will have the name of the typeface in parentheses somewhere on that slide as well. A lot of places I use the word hand gloves as a sample piece of text. It's sort of like Quick Brown Fox jumped over the lazy dog's dog in typing. It's a short word, and it highlights a lot of the characteristics of a typeface. And so typographers use it quite regularly to be able to give a sense of what a typeface is really all about. So an example there is Univers, and I use the word hand gloves to show off the characteristics of that particular typeface. I use lorem text in a lot of the samples. Lorem text is just nonsense letters strung together to look like words, but they aren't actually words. It's when you want to show off a characteristic that people can look at to see what something looks like without getting caught up in the fact that, you know, there's actual text that they're trying to read. In Microsoft Word, you can get that by just typing in equals lorem, open parentheses, close parentheses, and press enter. It'll give you a couple of paragraphs of it. In LibreOffice Writer, you go to Tools, Auto Text, Standard, and there's an option there for lorem ipsum, and that'll give you a couple of paragraphs of that lorem text. Most of the typefaces that I'm showing tonight are in Windows 10. There are some that are not. I didn't identify them specifically, but in the most part, you'll be able to find the typefaces that I show tonight are available to you in Windows 10. If you care, the base typeface I used in the presentation is Book Antiqua, and the word typography on the opening slide is Kamigata, which is available for free at defont.com. It's one of the nicer script fonts that I've come across and available for free. So Merriam-Webster defines typography as the style, arrangement, or appearance of types that matter. And I found that to be a little bit lacking, a little bit bland, and I went looking for a better definition, and I found a better one, I think, at Wikipedia. And they talk about the art and technique of arranging type, and the important thing is it being legible, readable, and appealing when displayed. And I think that's a much better definition of typography. It really gets across the essence of what you're trying to accomplish when you're dealing with typography. Typomania is defined as an obsession with typography, and you'll be happy to know if you come out of today's presentation with a bit of an obsession on typography, according to Eric Speakerman, who is a German typographer, it is incurable, but it's not lethal. And Matthew Carter, who is a British typographer, says the type is a beautiful group of letters, not a group of beautiful letters. And I think this is really important. We will be looking tonight at a lot of characters in depth, in particular single characters at a time and things like that, to really get at the essence of what a particular typeface is all about. But when it comes right down to it, when you're looking at type as a means of communicating information to people, you're really looking at the group of letters. You're not looking at individual letters. It's how it all comes together in a word, a sentence, paragraph, or a page of text. That's really what type is all about. Matthew Carter, just by out of interest as well, He has seven typefaces that are in the Museum of Modern Art. The New Yorker actually described him as being the most widely read man in the world, considering the amount of text and his commonly used fonts. He has quite a few fonts that are in Microsoft Windows, and he has a lot of typefaces that are available. So why should anybody care about typography? And I think it's all about clarity, and it's the ability to easily read text information. Clarity actually comes from two things: legibility, which is how you can distinguish one letter from another letter in a block of text. And then readability is how you string those letters all together into word sentences, blocks. How easy is it to read that sequence of letters? A couple of other reasons why you might be interested in typography: you might want to capture attention, like in Cooper Black, a very bold and in-your-face type of typeface. Or you might want to convey an emotion, such as Edwardian Script ITC. Just as a side point, I guess, ITC, if you ever see that in a font name or typeface name, that is the International Typeface Corporation. If you ever see MT, which a lot of the typefaces in Microsoft Windows have MT in the name, those are monotype fonts, so a different foundry. Let's look at some definitions. So a typeface is the glyphs, and glyphs are those individual elements that are either letters, numbers, punctuation, fractions, ligatures, any single entity within a group of characters that share a common design. So you have things like Barlow is a typeface, Goody Old Style, Skeena, which is a brand new font that was commissioned by Microsoft to become the default, or a candidate to become a default in Microsoft Windows, and Bell MT. So there's one of those monotype fonts. So those are typefaces. You have a typeface family when you take a given typeface and you apply it to a weight, a slant, or a width. You can have any or all three of those. So in weight, you have typical names like light, thin, regular, medium, bold, heavy, black, so forth. If you don't specify a style when you're specifying a complete typeface name, then it's a regular weight. Then you have slant, and it can be either Roman, which is upright, or italic. And if you don't specify it, then it's a Roman. And then you have a width, and it can be things like regular, condensed, expanded, semi-condensed, and so forth. And so, again, if you don't specify a width, then it's considered to be regular. So a typeface family can be Barlow, and that would be Barlow regular, Roman, and a regular width. Or you could have Barlow condensed light. And so Barlow is the typeface itself. The condensed is the width. The light is the weight. And because we didn't specify a slant, then it's Roman. Or we could have Barlow semi-condensed extra bold italic, where you have Barlow is the typeface, semi-condensed is the width, extra bold is the weight, and it's italic slant. Just a little bit of an aside, here's an example of a very large typeface family. And so this is the Barlow typeface family, and it's available in 9 different weights, 2 different slants, and 3 different widths. And you can actually get this for free at GitHub, and you can get all 54 of those font files in a collection and use them all free of charge. So then we get down to what's a font. So a font are the glyphs that are from a single typeface using a given style. So it can be a given weight, a given slant, and a given width at a particular size. So you might have something like Franklin Gothic Heavy 36 points. So Franklin Gothic is the typeface. Heavy is the weight. And because we didn't specify the slant, it's a Roman. We didn't specify width, so it's normal or regular. And it's at 36 point. Or you can go down to the bottom, Badoni MT is the typeface, condensed is the width, bold is the weight, and italic is the slant, and 48 point is the size. Now, a lot of people take shortcuts when it comes to talking about what is a font. For the non-pedantic amongst us all, a typeface is a font. A typeface at a given style is a font. A typeface at a given style and specific size is a font. You can just all refer to them all as a font. So Gabriola is a font. Garamond Italic is a font. Franklin Gothic Medium Condensed Italic 32 Point is a font. Then we start looking at categories of fonts. And this is one way or one subset, I guess, of a way of categorizing them. There's some more in-depth ones, but I'll just go through these. For most people, this suits the purpose of being able to classify your different typefaces. So you have serif typefaces, and they have that little extension lines that go out of the uprights on the letters. Those are the serifs. So Century is an example of a typeface that is a serif typeface. Sans serif doesn't have those little extensions. And Univers is an example of a sans serif. Slab serif is you take a sans serif and then you put on a very square serif onto it that is the same weight as the rest of the letters. And that gives you a slab serif, and Rockwell is an example of that. You have script typefaces, and those are the ones that look sort of like handwriting. Display and decorative are brought up at the same time because they're both very similar in their usage and so forth. They are used for large signage and things like that. The difference between display and decorative is the decorative usually evokes some sort of emotion about it or a place in time or something like that, whereas elephant doesn't really have a place or a time. Western certainly does. It gives you that sense of the old Wild West sort of idea. You have monospace fonts where every character is the same width. And I'll be bringing this up one other time in the whole presentation. Other than that, monospace fonts are very rarely actually used. And then you have symbol fonts, which are those things like Wingdings, where it's all these different symbols instead of actual letters and numbers. In addition to that, you'll have other typeface categories that you might come across as you delve into typography a little bit more. Things like grotesque, geometric, humanist, modern, old style, transitional, and so forth. I'm not going to get into them because a lot of them are very nuanced. And it's only the people that are really into design that typically worry about, you know, the differences between a humanist and a geometric typeface and so forth. But information is out there if you're into that sort of depth. And I have a lot of resources listed at the end that'll help cover that off. So if we look at the first thing that most people look at when they're choosing a typeface to use for a particular project, one of the first decisions usually is serif versus sans serif. So serif font, you can see, has those little extensions on the ends of the letters. It might make text easier to read. The conventional wisdom going back 30, 40, 50 years ago was that serifs, they made a definite difference in readability. And the idea behind the serifs is it helps guide your eye along long lines of text. That's becoming a little bit less recognized as being a thing now. Sans serif fonts are considered to be as readable as serif fonts. An interesting thing is if you look at the names of those two typefaces, Bodoni MT and Callisto MT, if you look at the words there, they don't look dramatically different. But if you look at the enlarged versions of them, there are actually significant differences in the way those letters are actually shaped. And keep in mind as we go through this, as you put things down smaller, those effects will still be not in your face noticeable, but they will affect the way that people react to words that you're putting down onto a piece of paper. If we look at a sans serif font, they tend to stand out more. They're starker and so forth. They can be good in larger, shorter text, but they can use quite effectively in small ones as well. So there we have two examples of it, Verdana and Gil Sans MT. Oh, and just by the way, that's not a serif that I'm pointing at there now. That's actually an ear So lowercase g's are the only characters that can have ears on them. If we look at more in the anatomy of the type and the parts of the glyphs, so you see in red are the serifs. So if you were to chop off those red parts, you would end up with a sans serif typeface. The ascender is the parts of lowercase letters that rise above that midline or the top line of most of the lowercase letters. The descender is the parts of glyphs that go down below the baseline. The counters are the open areas within letters. You can have enclosed counters, such as the P and the top half of the A, or you can have open counters, like the rest of the counters that you see on there. And if you have open counters, you also have apertures, which is the size of the opening from the counter to the outside of the character. Some of the dimensions, we have baseline, which is the line that the glyphs rest on. You have the X height, which is the height of the lowercase x, and a line going across that is called the median line. We have a cap height, which is the height of capital letters. And if you have letters that have flat tops versus pointy tops, cap height is measured across the letters that have a flat top, and you ignore the point on the capitals that go above that. And then you have the ascender height, which usually is actually higher than the cap height. So it's the height of the ascenders of lowercase letters. You have a descender height, which is the distance that the descenders go down below the baseline. And then you have the leading, which is the line spacing. So it's the distance from one baseline to another baseline. If we look at the X height, which is another consideration that you start to get into after you've looked at previous ones we've mentioned. Here's some examples going from Goody Old Style up to Antonio. And I put in the percentage of relationship of the X height to the cap height. And it goes from 0.6 on Goody Old Style, which is a very low X height, up to Antonio at 0.85, which is an extremely large X height. You'll never see that listed on typefaces. You know, they don't talk about Goody Old Style being a 0.6 or anything like that. They only talk about things being a small X height or a large X height or regular X height. And so that's typically the way you'll see things described. And irrespective of the other differences, like one of them being a serif and one of them being a sans serif, you can see how there's a considerable different feel to Goody Old Style with a very low X height to Antonio with a very high or large X height. A lot of the normal typefaces that you'll run across will have an X height close to about 0.7. Things like Gil Sans and Barlow or Times New Roman, Arial, Cambria, all of them are running in around the 0.7 as the X height. It's when you get down into the 0.65 and below that they're considered to be a small X height. And when you get up around 0.75 or above, they're considered typically to be a large X height. And you can see in the text here a little bit of the effect of a small X height. So with a small X height, you tend to cramp your lowercase letters a little bit. And that can actually give you a little bit more or a little bit harder time in making out the individual letters. But overall, you end up with a more airy feeling because of the extra space in between the lines of characters. If you have a large X height, like Antonio, the space within the letters starts to open up a little bit, which might make it more legible. However, as the ascenders get smaller, it can cause readability issues. And to show you the example of how that effect really comes in, before I jump, if you are mixing faces, so you have a block of text and you have, say, subheads that are going to be in a different typeface than your body text, if you are mixing faces like that, a similar X height in the two different typefaces that you choose can create a sense of harmony in it. So something to think about. Now, if we look at ascenders and the readability factor on that, ascenders, it turns out, are quite important to readability. And this is one of the reasons why most of the time you want to avoid all caps, because you give up all of your senders if you're in all caps. So how easily can you read the following? Versus, how easy can you read this? I think most people will find that the second one is easier to read than the first one. And if we look at the pair of them on there, and you just think about how easily you can read those two lines of text, the ascenders actually give you an awful lot of information about the words. And so ascenders are very important, and that's why large X height typefaces can be a little bit more problematic when it comes to readability. For the counters, if you have closed counters, or very small counters, they can be difficult to read. They can come into some other problems that I'll talk about a little bit later on, but even just in blocks of text, it can make it difficult to actually read them. And there's a very compact appearance to that. Now, Onyx is a little bit unusual font in that it's very stretched vertically or compressed horizontally, but you can see how the closed-in counters can make it a little bit hard to distinguish the different characters properly. If you have something like Corbel, which has a very open counter, they tend to be more readable, and they're legible even when you get into really small sizes, because they don't come down and fill in so that you can't make out the counters all that well. And you can see in the blocks of text how Corbel is a very readable font because it's very open in its counters. For strokes, you can have stressed strokes, as we see here with Goody Old Style, and that's where if you look at the capital H, you'll see that the uprights are thicker than the crossbar on the H. You can see on the bowl of the D, where different parts of the bowl of the D are thinner or thicker. You can also have a directional slant to your strokes, or it can be an upright. Very, very rarely, you can actually have a directional slant that goes the opposite direction. Usually, it's from the top left to the bottom right, but I've seen a couple of typefaces where they actually reverse that. They look really, really odd, but they're out there. So stressed typefaces have a the reason why they came about, they were meant to mimic calligraphy. And so that's why you have it when you do calligraphy, you end up naturally with parts of your letters are thicker than other parts. And that's what it's the stressed strokes is meant to mimic. Or you can have something like Barlow, which is an unstressed typeface. And they have even strokes. And there's no change in weight or very little change in weight. In this case here with Barlow, there is a little bit of stressing. So if we look at the G, you can see that the outside of the G is a little bit thicker than on the bowl where it joins the stem. But by and large, it's very, very consistent in the weight of the stroke. They can be a lot easier to read if you look at all kinds of different sizes, from big signs to small boilerplate text and things like that. And a lot of the time you want unstressed typefaces if legibility is really of utmost importance to you, rather than having something that has character to it. For slant, you can have a true italic. And a true italic is when the glyphs that are angled have different characteristics than the uprights or Roman versions of them. And you can see that quite clearly on, say, the A, where Callisto MT as a Roman typeface is a dual story, whereas the italic version of Callisto MT, it's actually a single story A. You can see it really dramatically on the F, where it takes on completely different characteristics when you go to the italic version. Or you can have an oblique. And oblique typefaces are ones where the angle glyphs take on the same characteristics as the upright or the Roman version of it. Now, they don't have to be all identical, but for the most part, they will be very similar. A true italic font could be finely tuned on certain characters where the designer will decide to modify the shape of letter slightly just for artistic reasons or legibility reasons or something like that. But by and large, they share the same characteristics as the Roman version. In the true italics, not all of the characters have to be different than the Roman. You can have some of them that, you know, they can be quite similar, but you will see at least some of the glyphs will have different characteristics. Let's talk about figures. And first we'll talk about the form of figures. You can have lining figures, which have a uniform height, and they tend to be very nice in tables, like Book Antiqua is one example that has lining figures. Or you can have old-style figures. And old-style figures will have ascenders and descenders. And they tend to be nice in running text. You can also have very subtle old-style figures. This is one I just came across today, actually. It's a new typeface that was put out by Monotype called Harmonique. And it has ascenders and descenders on the 3, 4, 5, 7 for descenders, and 6 and 8 having ascenders. But it's very, very subtle. You can see there's very little difference on there. But they are actually old-style figures. If we look at some running text, and you look at the first one with Book Antiqua, where we have lining figures, and then compare it to Candera, which has old-style figures, I think by and large in running text, old-style figures have a little bit more elegance to them. They look kind of nice. But if you throw them into a table, old-style figures, Candera, look kind of odd in a table. You sort of expect numbers in tables to be block-like, like the cell that they're filling and so forth. So by and large, lining figures are going to look better in a table than old-style figures will. Then you have figures, you have the spacing of the figures. So you can have either tabular, where they have uniform width. So this is sort of like the Courier New, you know, monospaced font. Well, this is just the figures being monospaced. Or you can have proportional, where they have a non-uniform width. And so if we look at running text between, say, Gil Sans MT, which has tabular figures, and you can see odd sort of spacing, where the ones are taking up the same amount of space as the other figures. Compare that to proportional figures like Bonschrift, where it has different spacing for different widths of glyphs in the numbers. Now, quite frankly, when it comes to it, one is the only figure that is significantly different width than the other numbers. So in many cases, you won't really notice a huge difference unless, like my example where I had four ones in it, that Gil Sans tends to look a little bit odd. So you might not notice this effect quite as much as you might expect to see it. However, in tabular, in tables of numbers, definitely uniform width tabular numbers are a lot better to deal with than proportional figures. So if you look at Bonschrift on the right-hand side, I mean, these are all numbers that are between, you know, they're all in the single-digit millions. But if you look at, for example, you know, it almost looks like the upper number there, 28797328, is bigger than 7191211, you know, because it's spread out more horizontally. So definitely when you're doing tables of numbers, it's a lot better to deal with them using uniform width or tabular numbers. Now, some typefaces that are in open type format, they can support either tabular or proportional or lining and old style. So the way to get to that is the font dialog box in Microsoft Word. You go to the advanced tab and you have open type features and you have the number spacing, and you might be able to choose between proportional and tabular. And for number forms, you might be able to choose lining or old style. Not all fonts provide this for you. In LibreOffice Writer, you go to Format Character, and then on the Font tab on that dialog box, there's a Features section where you'd be able to choose those. Calibri is one of those typefaces that allow you to choose that. So for a table of figures, you could do it tabular lining. And for running text, you could actually choose proportional old style. So you get the best of both worlds in that. Calibri's default, by the way, is tabular and lining. So for those people who never knew that you could actually change that, they end up with tabular lining throughout their documents. So they're running text where they could take advantage of the fact that maybe they would prefer proportional old style. They're not taking advantage of that because they didn't know they had that availability to them. Speaking about OpenType, so there's two font formats that are used commonly in computers, and TrueType and OpenType. TrueType was developed by Apple and Microsoft in the early 80s. OpenType was developed by Adobe and Microsoft in the late 90s. The OpenType fonts support more advanced features. So you have things like small caps, alternate characters, fractions, true fractions, not just 1/3. You know, it'll be a true fractional character. It'll be one glyph that represents that fraction. Ligatures, contextual alternatives, lots of other features that can be in it. They can support about, I think it's something like 30,000 glyphs in a single font file. So a huge number of alternate characters and so forth that are available to you in OpenType. For designers, they almost universally are going to want to use OpenType because they will use those additional features. You and me, probably not going to use a lot of those features, but if a font is available in both OpenType as well as TrueType, I would always go for the OpenType. Just gives you the additional capabilities if you choose to use them. Let's look at OpenType stylistic sets, which I find really cool. Not all typefaces have stylistic sets associated with them. Gabriola, which is one of the fonts in Microsoft Windows, does have stylistic sets. So if you go in and you select the stylistic set, one will give you that first example, and it's a little bit of a calligraphic type of font, but not super fancy. Then you get down to stylistic set 4, you start getting almost ball terminals on some of the ascenders. A little bit fancier. The G, lowercase g, is a little bit fancier. Then you get into stylistic set 7, and you get into these really, really wild, flourishes on the letters. If you want to check out if your OpenType typeface actually has stylistic sets, if you go in Windows to the font dialog box, and on the Advanced tab, there's a drop box for stylistic sets. And you can just go in and check out what they are. They're all just numbered in there, so you just choose them and see what you get. In LibreOffice Writer, you go to Format, Character, and on the Font tab, there's a Features section where you can choose the stylistic set. One of the things I'll point out, too, is that some of the stylistic sets actually have what is known as contextual alternatives. And as an example of this, if you look at the L, and you see how the flourish goes on this in hand gloves, and then you compare it to the L that is in the word Gabriola, it's a considerably different shape. And so what the type designer has the ability to do is actually go through the font and character by character basically say, if this character is to the left of this character, I want this stylistic adaptation to it. If it's beside this other character, I want it to look different. And they will build that in, and it'll automatically do it according to the context of where that particular glyph is. Another one that's available in Windows is Impact, that has stylistic sets. And so you can see in this one here, in particular, things like the L and the O can look different depending on the stylistic set, or the way the E comes down below the S, or in this case here, the E is just got the bar below the letter E. So just different stylistic sets that are available in particular fonts. I highly encourage you to try them out, see what they can give you.
Chris, question here.
Sure.
The Gabriola set 7, how do you get the first flourish?
By virtue of the fact that I had an H on there, it just gave that to me. You just have to try the letters and see what they will actually do. You can actually see in here, and let me just highlight it here. So in the when I was choosing stylistic set 7, and it gave me whatever my currently selected text was in my document, which was the word Gabriola, and you can see that the flourish on the capital G is considerably different than the capital H in hand gloves. It's just luck of the draw what you get. Montserrat is an interesting one I found. It also has stylistic sets, just has a couple of them. But boy, are they ever different. It's like it's a completely different font. If you look at stylistic set zero, it's very squared off letters and things like that, whereas stylistic set one is very rounded characters. If you look at the capital A, you know, it considerably different. You know, the tail on the Q is way different. The crossbar on the T, you know, the uppercase T, is considerably different. It's almost like they're just completely different typefaces. I was really blown away by how different that stylistic set really was. When it comes to font size, surprisingly, and this was, well, surprised me, it's somewhat arbitrary. First off, there is 72 points to the inch, but the points is not the actual glyph itself. It's the height of the lead mold that was used in the original designing of type. It is a few points bigger than the distance between the top of the ascender and the bottom of the descender, which is there to make sure that you don't have collisions between characters in multiple lines of text. But the type designer is free to define the font size completely differently. Let's look at four different fonts that we have here, and we can see that the cap height is considerably different between those four, yet they are all set to 96 points. This really blew me away as being like, what? You have to really watch for this because the particular font that you choose may have a completely different cap height than some other font set to the same point size. I got this quote off of a website. There's no universally valid basis for body height usage and the font size this ultimately delivers. That's really bizarre, but true. You also have character widths. So these are three different typefaces that have been set to the same point size, and you can see that there's considerable different widths in the characters. So I put in A to Z in uppercase and lowercase, and one of the things I found really interesting was if you look at Callisto and Georgia, the lowercase alphabet, Georgia, is wider, but the uppercase, Callisto, is wider, which is kind of strange when you think about it, that you would sort of expect them to be more consistently wider or narrower, but not the case with these ones. On top of that, you have different stroke weights, you have different flourishes on characters, different descenders, tails on cues that can all affect the readability or the character of a particular typeface. If you look at the cues on there, the tails are really a lot different. And I find George is much plainer. Book Antiqua and Callisto MT, both of them have quite elegant tails on them. If you look at the capital J between George and Book Antiqua actually has a descender on the capital J. It's also a lot narrower than the capital J in Georgia. The C, if you look at Book Antiqua, it's a lot wider than the capital C in Georgia, for example. All of these go into making a different flavor to a particular typeface and may make it more or less attractive for you to use in a particular project. Leading is the line spacing. And if you have long lines, or if you have compact typefaces, or if you have large X heights, you might find that increasing the leading will help the guide the eye along the line and allow the reader to get from the end of one line back to the start of the next line, as you see in the red sections. And you might notice a little bit easier in the one with the increased leading that I actually skipped a line when I went from the red at the end of one line to the red at the start of the next line, only I skipped a line. It's more noticeable in the one where there was the added leading than it is in the one that is tighter leading. Tracking is where you adjust the spacing between all the letters, and this is pretty much only used in write-justified text, where the right end of the line, they all line up the same way they do on the left side of the line. And you can see in this particular example here how it created these extra gaps that are really, really ugly in the text. By just adjusting the tracking, I did nothing other than adjusting the tracking on this. I got rid of those ugly gaps. Now it starts to compress the text a little bit. It might hurt readability in some cases. This was done in Microsoft Word, which the tracking in Microsoft Word is not as sophisticated as a lot of true typesetting programs. So it's not as good at doing the job, but you can see how it eliminated those ugly gaps. But this idea of having right-justified text and causing these gaps in the first place is one reason why a lot of people will avoid right-justified text and just go with ragged right. Kerning. Kerning is when you adjust the spacing between certain letter pairs. And what the aim is to get optically the space in between those letters to be similar. And so if we look in Arial, and in these cases, I have green is the end of the first letter, and red line is the start of the second letter. And you can see how with N and M, there is a space between them like that. But when you get into the other ones, where you have T and O, as well as in A and V, the start of the second letter actually is to the left of the end of the first letter. So they actually overlap a little bit. You can also get a font such as Roboto. And you can see in this case, although there is some kerning that's going on, in no example in there do you have the second letter actually overlapping the first letter. And I saw some criticism on the internet where people were saying, well, Roboto's got really crappy kerning. Well, this is going to be my first example of appropriate use. Because if we think about what was Roboto actually designed for, it might make more sense than if we just blanket say it has lousy kerning. Roboto was designed by Google to be used as a system font in Android. So what is Android used for? It's on tiny screens for phones and tiny little text. Maybe it makes sense to not kern as aggressively in a case like that, because as things get smaller and smaller, you're going to end up with more readability issues if you cram text more together. So maybe that is an appropriate amount of kerning for its particular use. Start to think about this as you go through selecting typefaces and different aspects of the way that you use your typefaces to see, is this an appropriate use for this particular typeface? If you are doing white on black or light on dark, as opposed to dark on light, you'll find that in all cases, white on black will always look heavier than black on white. Those letters are actually the same stroke width throughout them all, but the white on black looks a lot heavier than the black on white. If you're doing signage and things like that, or anything where you're reversing the text, keep that in mind, because you might want to choose a typeface that has a lighter weight if you are doing white on black. So, talk about choosing a typeface. So some of the considerations you should think about are, what was the original design intent and criteria for that particular typeface? Think back to Roboto. You know, it made sense for what it was designed for. Always think about clarity, legibility, readability of your typeface. You want people to read your text. Think about the effect that a particular typeface will have. You know, is it casual, bold, formal, fun? What is the intended use? If you are designing an annual report for IBM, you probably are not going to choose the same typeface that you'll choose for a poster that you're putting up about a garage sale that you're having. If you are using different typefaces for headings and bodies or subheadings and body, don't make them too similar, because if you make them similar, they tend to blend together, and with either headings and body or subheads and body, you want them to really stand out and be distinctive. Don't mix too many typefaces. General rule, one or two is the best to stick with, unless you really know what you're doing. Let's look at a couple of typefaces. Times New Roman. So it was designed for the Times of London newspaper. It was based on a previous typeface called Plantin, and it was modified for economy of space. It was crammed in. The letter spacing is less The glyphs are actually narrower than plantain. And the reason was that newspapers wanted to be able to fit lots of text on their page. An interesting thing was that the Times was printed on better paper than other newspapers of the time. And so that allowed them to use sharp serifs, stressed letter forms, a little bit more elegant look to it than other newspapers were able to pull off, because if they had cheaper paper, the inks tended to bleed more and you didn't get those sharp serifs and so forth. So it allowed them to distinguish themselves from other newspapers that were out. It is horizontally compact, and so therefore it's quite suited to narrow columns. It is one of the most overused typefaces. And Matthew Butterick, who is a American typographer, he worked mostly around in the he's pretty young. He was born in 1970, so he's still around doing his job. And he said the Times New Roman is not so much a font choice as an absence of font choice. And I think that stems from the fact that it used to be the default font in Microsoft Word. And so if you opened up a new Word document and you didn't choose the font, you ended up with Times New Roman. So we had a lot of text out there in Times New Roman. Okay, Frutiger. So it was designed by Adrian Frutiger for the Charles de Gaulle Airport. It was inspired by two previous fonts, Univers and Peignot. And Peignot was actually designed for an airport as well. So some of the design criteria for Frutiger is they wanted legibility at all angles, sizes, distances. You might be looking down a concourse that's a quarter mile long. You might be looking across an aisle at a sign that is 10 feet away. They wanted ascenders and descenders to be very prominent. They wanted wide apertures so that you could easily distinguish letters one from another. So they wanted that legibility had to be really high. They wanted to have it. If you're heading for gate 22, you don't end up at gate 77 because you couldn't make out the numbers correctly. And Adrian Frutiger said what was important was total clarity. He would even call it nudity and absence of any kind of artistic addition. He had no interest in it being a pretty font. He wanted it to be clear. He wanted that you'd be able to look down that concourse and say, yes, international arrivals, that's down there. It turns out that it was very popular for corporate and transportation branding in particular, and it is actually the best-selling Linotype Foundry typeface right now. So if we think about cross-purposes, so if you think, well, Times New Roman, it was designed for tight text and narrow columns. So does that mean I can't use it for, full page width body text? Or Frutiger was designed for big signs. So does that mean I can't use it for body text in a book? Well, of course you can. Just be aware of what it was originally designed for. What were the criteria that they had when they created that? And does that suit your particular use of that typeface? If it does, it's probably good. If it doesn't have the same purpose in mind, think seriously about whether it will work well for your usage. Transport was created for the UK Department of Transport for road signage. And part of the design criteria they had, they wanted really open counters, and they wanted letter-spaced font, so the words are spread out a little bit, yet they wanted to retain the word shape. So it didn't start to fall apart into individual letters. It still retained that essence of being a word. The reason why they had both of those criteria was to offset the effect of halation. So halation is when you shine a headlight on a sign, and you get that glare filling in the counters and the space in between the letters, making it harder to read them. And they wanted that at full decision-making distances, at high speeds. I think they had it that at 600 feet was what they wanted you to be able to distinguish the letters easily. And they actually tested this by having this car racing down this road. And they put up signs, and they changed the typeface a little bit, and they said, okay, let us know when you can read the sign. And that's the way they decided that they was overcoming the effect of halation to the degree that they really wanted to. Is it only good for road signs? Well, if you go to the Government of UK website, that's their only font that they use on their website is Transport. And you can download it for free if you want. They also came up with Pavement, which is a vertically stretched version of Transport Medium. There were only 74 glyphs in the entire typeface, and you can see the glyphs that are actually there. And it was interesting, I thought, sometimes when you have these specialized typefaces, how do you get those characters? And it turns out that what they do is that the first row is what they have for low-speed roads, and then if you hold down the shift key, you'll get the larger stretch ones that are designed for higher-speed roads. And the numbers, they weren't matching up for me. So if I did shifted one, I wasn't getting the taller version of the number one. Well, it turns out that the shifting works, but only if you have a UK keyboard running on your computer. And then it matches up. So if you wanted the tall version of 7, you hold down Shift 7, and you would get that. And you can download Pavement for free as well. So if you want to go and do signage around your neighborhood on your roads, you can go ahead and get Pavement for free from the UK. Alan, do we have any burning questions? I guess not.
No, there's nothing right now, Chris.
Okay. Bell Centennial is an interesting typeface. It was designed by Matthew Carter for AT&T. They wanted to have a new typeface for their Centennial, which was in 1970, something around in there, I think it was. They wanted to replace what they had been using in their phone books, Bell Gothic. And the design criteria, they wanted more characters per line without losing legibility at small point sizes, which we all know, phone books, small point sizes. They figured that they could actually save over $1 million a year by coming up with something that was more compact. They also wanted to reduce the effect of ink spread on poor quality paper. We also know that telephone books are printed on really crappy paper because they don't want to spend money on good paper. And the lousier the paper is and smaller the font is, the more you get bleed in where you make it hard to distinguish individual characters and numbers. So they came up with this. So this is Bell Centennial at 160 point, which is never actually used, and it looks really bizarre. And the reason is they built in ink traps. This is how ink traps actually work. So they're designed to actually allow the ink to bleed in on that poor quality paper and still retain the shape of the letter. So does that mean it's only useful in tiny sizes on cheap paper? Well, Mazda UK used it, you know, in mid-1990s ads, and the English National Opera actually advertised one of their productions in 2010 using Bell Centennial. I hope they did that consciously and not just, oh, this looks sort of pretty, and, you know, they use it that way. But it definitely has been used for other purposes other than tiny sizes on cheap paper. Retina is another similar one. It was designed for the Wall Street Journal, and it was specifically designed for printing out their stock pages where there's lots of tiny text. And the design criteria was similar to what we saw in Bell Centennial, that they wanted legibility at small point sizes, so they used ink traps. And you can see the ink traps in the top right screenshot of Retina. And they wanted an additional one. They wanted equal width despite having different weights. Normally, if you go to a bold version of a typeface, the characters get wider. They wanted it like this, where no matter what weight it was, it would still retain the same width, so numbers would line up even if some of them were bolded. It was updated in 2016, and this was for on-screen viewing. So bringing it into more of the computerized thing, they still wanted small point size characters, but they wanted it hinted, which allows the characters to line up with a pixel grid, and so it aids readability. Let's talk about some inappropriate or some cross-purposes that maybe weren't as successful. So here we have a sign that was put up on a corporate environment on a meeting room door, and they used Comic Sans as the typeface. And somebody came along and told them, you really shouldn't do that because we're not a lemonade stand. And that unleashed the internet hate machine when people started using Comic Sans all over the place, and it brought out websites that are designed to get rid of or advocating the complete elimination of Comic Sans. And we had things like the Ban Comic Sans website that said using Comic Sans is like turning up to a black tie event in a clown costume. You had jokes. Comic Sans walks into a bar, the bartender says, "We don't serve your type." And Vincent Conner, who actually designed Comic Sans for Microsoft, he came out and said, "If you love Comic Sans, you don't know much about typography. If you hate it, you really don't know much about typography either, and you should get another hobby." In the 1990s, Microsoft was designing a program called Microsoft Bob, and it used the room metaphor for computing. So if you wanted to write a letter, you might click on, you know, the sheets of paper. If you wanted to do your finances, you click on that, it would open up some kind of financial planner. If you wanted your calendar, you click on that, and it would pop up. And they had this little dog that would guide you through the program and give you help. And its speech balloon was in Times New Roman. Now, Melinda French was the product manager for Microsoft Bob, and she went to Vincent Conner, who was the typographer at Microsoft, and said, "What do you think of the typefaces that we're using in the program?" And Vincent Conner looked at it and said, "Dogs don't talk in Times New Roman." And he set about actually designing Comic Sans as a replacement. Unfortunately, the product was too far down along the line, and the way that they were doing typefaces and so forth at the time, they couldn't just swap in a wider font for the Times New Roman. It just wouldn't fit. So Microsoft Bob actually shipped with Rover Retriever talking in Times New Roman. If we look back at that quote of saying using Comic Sans is like turning up at a black tie event in a clown costume, I think maybe using Times New Roman might be like turning up in black tie for the circus. Appropriate use for the use that you have for the particular typeface is what's important. There's nothing wrong with Comic Sans. It may be inappropriate in certain circumstances. It has shown up in some pretty strange places. So a defibrillator machine just doesn't seem to match, you know, what you think of when you think about a defibrillator. Or how about a book that the staff at the Vatican put together for Pope Benedict, all done in Comic Sans. Just doesn't quite feel right. LeBron James with "I Can't Breathe." It doesn't seem to fit with the seriousness of Black Lives Matter. Or the Surrey police who put out a bulletin, and yes, they actually use Comic Sans in a bulletin about rape. Now, I'm happy to say that this is not Surrey, BC, but actually Surrey in the UK that actually used this. Or CERN, the particle physics people, who announced that they were going to switch all of their official communications to use Comic Sans. Now, fortunately, the next day on April 2nd, they actually went back to their original typeface. But all of those are examples that maybe it's not the right place to use something like Comic Sans. Let's talk about display typefaces. And the reason, more than anything else, I'm going to talk about display typefaces is they are so dramatically large that you really get the character of the different glyphs that are in a typeface. And
just break in before you go to really big fonts. Tom wants to know, are there any sub-pixel fonts?
Sub-pixel. That'd be an interesting thought. Not that I'm aware of. I don't know how you would actually display them if you had sub-pixel.
A very tiny font, I guess.
Yeah. Can't think of it. I don't know. The smallest that I've seen typically is around 5.5 point, and that's the stuff that you typically will see in a phone book, the stock listings, things like that. That's about the smallest typefaces that I've actually seen. You get much smaller than that, and you really have a hard time rendering characters that you can actually distinguish one character from another correctly. So when you're using display typefaces, you know, there is a very dramatic effect that you see there. Now, before I actually get into showing a lot more of those, I'm going to go back to body text. So this is the blocks of text that you'll have in your book, your magazine article, and so forth. The effect of those typefaces is still there. It's just more subtle. So if we look at these two examples, Candera versus Montserrat. Candera is a little bit more relaxed feeling to it. Montserrat, a little bit more formal. If we look closely at a couple of the letters, you look at the T, the upright has a little bit of a slant to it. We have a little bit of a difference in the weight of it throughout the character in Candera, whereas in Montserrat, much more formal. The P in Candera actually slants a little bit over to the left. You'll see that the counters in Montserrat are very round, very geometric. In a capital M, you actually have a splayed capital M in Candera, and you can see there's a little bit of a wavy shape to the strokes in Candera, whereas the M in Montserrat, very formal, very upright, and so forth. So although in the smaller text, it's a little bit harder to pick it out, that character does come across as you're reading that particular text. So keep that in mind in body text. But now what we're going to do is we're going to look at really big in-your-face differences. So what if we had a company and the sign outside it said, you know, the name of the company, Canadian Finance. Would it be more appropriate to have it in Castellar or Verdana? Yeah, it's interesting. How about Colonial Furniture? You know, Old English? Looks pretty appropriate. Chiller, maybe not so much. How about a lemonade stand? You know, you could use Impact. Very much in your face, very bold, very striking. Or you use something like Andy, which is much more like you would expect from a child writing in a hand-lettered sign. The Lab Lamp Shop. You know, Retrophile has that very 70s psychedelic hippie sort of jive to it, whereas Perpetua, a little bit more formal. Maybe Retrophile would be a more appropriate typeface to use for the Lava Lamp Shop. Or Poetry Tea House. You know, Lucida Handwriting has a little bit more, you know, relaxed, artistic feel to it, rather than Noto Sans, which is an upright, very formal typeface. Or how about Foothills Bar and Grill? Business of that. You know, you could do Magneto or Western. Now, this one, I picked these ones in particular because I wanted to point out that it's not necessarily one or the other, depending on the circumstance. So Magneto, that might be a good typeface to use if you were trying to attract 20-somethings to your bar and grill. Whereas Foothills Bar and Grill in Western, that might be more appropriate if you're trying to attract, you know, retirement community, people in their 50s, 60s, and older. It might be more appropriate. So think about what is the use, what is the emotion that you're trying to get across when you're putting out your text. Let's look at an iconic use of type, and that's a stop sign. We've all seen hundreds of thousands of them. And so let's look at what if it was in Garamond. Is that appropriate? It just jars as not being really appropriate. It's a stressed typeface. It has serifs on it. You know, somehow it just doesn't work. If you go to 4K, you're going in the wrong direction. I mean, it's getting even worse. If you look at Penna, okay, well, all of a sudden, yeah, we're getting a little bit more like we expect a stop sign to be. It's kind of thin, but we've dropped the stressing on the letters and we've dropped the serifs. So that's getting in the right direction. Or you can go to Century Gothic. Now we're getting there. Okay, so when you get to that point, all of a sudden you're having no stressing, thicker font, no serifs, looks a little bit better. Not quite there yet. And then we come to Highway Gothic. And Highway Gothic was actually designed in the late 40s for the U.S. Federal Highway Administration. And that's why it seems so familiar, is that it is used all over North America, most of Europe, and so forth. Now, there's a new typeface called Clearview, which has gotten, it's had a little bit of back and forth and its approval and so forth in the States. It is used some places in the States, some places in Canada. It has a little bit wider counters, so it opens up the typeface a little bit. The X height on it is a little bit increased, although this is all uppercase. For other signage where you have mixed case, it has a little bit larger X height than Highway Gothic has. So it looks like it's probably going to take over as being the typeface for use on signage on roads in North America, at least. Let's look at word marks. They're kind of fun. So here we have Good Foods. And so what they did was they started off with Avenir Black as their typeface, and then they replaced the O's with fruit. Kind of neat. It really gives that, evokes the feeling of you know, shopping for food. This one I think was brilliant, Sofa World. So they have Futura Black for the word sofa, so very sturdy, upright, solid. And then they take Garamond Italic for the word world, so Garamond Italic, more elegant, more comfortable. So you have Sofa World, sturdy but comfortable. Kind of neat. Somebody was really thinking there. How about Intact Insurance? They use Bodoni for the actual word intact. Very elegant. It's got ball terminals on the A and the C. It's a very elegant typeface. So you take that and then you protect it with heavy square brackets. Hey, insurance protecting you. Very elegant, but protected. Kind of neat. Zara is a fashion retailer that based in Spain, and this was their old word mark. So Zara. And they decided that they wanted to update their word mark. And so they started out with Linotype's Dido Pro Bold, and then they modified that, so they tightened up the letter spacing considerably, they thinned down the strokes, they brought the A up to a point rather than having it capped off with a straight line, they opened up the counters, like if you look at the R, the counter on the R is opened up quite a bit, and this was very polarizing. Some people loved it, and most designers hated it. So one said, the new Zara logo has been kerned into oblivion. Eric Speakerman, who we saw on one of the first slides there, the German typographer, said it's the worst piece of type he's seen in years. Was it done by one of those new robots that will replace humans? So there was a guy on Twitter who tweeted out that, okay, there was Zara's word mark in 2011. 8 years later, that was their new word mark. They figured, give it another 8 years, and this will be Zara's word mark in 2027. Metropolitan Museum of Art, their old logo, was actually brilliant. And I actually have it here in two sizes, because if you look at the small size in particular, this is as if you saw the logo at a distance. And what is really prominent is the M. So you see the other faint lines, but the M is really prominent. As you get closer and closer, all of a sudden these other geometric shapes start coming out at you. And really nice to have these, you know, circles and lines and so forth as part of Museum of Art. And then they came out with their new logo. And some critics and so forth came out. The new logo was a typographical bus crash. Alan Pekulek, who is a graphic designer, he's done a lot of logo work and that for large corporations and so forth, just said, why did you do this? Another one that was really polarizing. Okay, let's look at building a document. So some of the ways that you can distinguish headings from body text or subheadings from body text are, you know, there's a number of different ways you can do it. You could use the same typeface for the headings and the body, and use a different size, weight, or placement for your heading or subheading. You can pair fonts. So you could use two different typefaces. If you're pairing, don't have things that are too similar, because that sort of is very unsettling for people to read things where they are trying to distinguish them as being different, but they're too similar. And especially if you use both serifs or both sans serifs. Use typefaces sparingly when you're using different ones. I put a link there, and I have a link later on how to pair typefaces. Quite frankly, I don't understand typeface pairing. It's beyond me, but there are a number of resources that talk about good pairings. Okay, so we're going to look, rather than heads and body text, I'm going to look at subheads and body text and how you can make them stand out. So here's an example how we use the same typeface, so Barlow, same size, but then we just gave a different weight to one. So the subheadings are a little bit bolder. Or you might use different typeface. So in this case here, we use the serif typeface for the body text and a sans serif for the subheads. We left them the same size, but one is a little bit bolder than the other. Or maybe we want to use the same typeface, and we just change the size for the subheads, just to make the subheads stand out a little bit. Or in this case, what we did was we used different typefaces. So again, we went with a sans serif for the subheads, a serif for the body text, and then we used the same type, same point size, but we did different color for the subheads to make them stand out. Or here where we did all kinds of things. So we have a different typeface. So again, we used the sans serif for the subhead, a serif for the body text. We have a different color for the subheads. We have a different size, so the subheads are a little bit larger. We do a first line indent on the body, and we do an outdent on the subhead. Makes it stand out quite a lot. So all those different methods can be used to make your subheads stand out. Some you might find better than others. It's a personal decision on how you want to make your subheads stand out from your headings.
Okay. Yeah. Tom's asking, what's the place of underlining?
The place of underlining? Underlining nowadays in typefaces is pretty much gone away. It had its heyday in the world of typewriters, where you didn't have things like italics to make things stand out. So by and large, nowadays you avoid underlining, is the general rule that I hear. So some typography rules. If you're hyphens and dashes, no space before or after. A hyphen is used to join words, so UpToDate Antivirus, Rock Hard Candy, Ex-Wife, that's the use of a hyphen. An N-dash is a little bit wider than a hyphen, and it's used to separate a range, so 2019 through 2020. You can get that on your keyboard using Alt and 0150 on the numeric keypad will give you an N-dash. In Microsoft Word and LibreOffice Writer, it will autocorrect if you do a word, space, hyphen, space, and another word. It will correct that hyphen into an N dash, but it won't take out the spaces, so you have to go back in and remove them. An M dash, think of it as a break in a sentence, like the fee increase opposed by all went ahead. You can get that on the keyboard by doing Alt and 0151 on the numeric keypad, or in Microsoft Word, you can do Control Alt minus, will give you an M dash. Or in Word or LibreOffice Writer, it will autocorrect if you do two hyphens. It'll autocorrect those to an M dash. Indents and line spacing are two different ways that you can distinguish between paragraphs. So the first example that you see at the top there is where we used extra leading between the paragraphs. The second example is where we did no extra leading between the paragraphs, but we indent the first line. And the third is the mistake where you actually combine both of those. Matthew Betterick, a typographer, said first line indents and spaces between paragraphs have the same relationship as belts and suspenders. You only need one to get the job done. Using both is a mistake. Justifying text versus ragged write. There is a general consensus that the subtle spacing adjustments that need to be done in order to do write justified text is very difficult. Okay, professional typesetting equipment can do it. Microsoft Word can't, and that's why a lot of people will just go with ragged write rather than doing justified text in their word processing. If you are doing ragged write, your rag should be irregular. You don't want a noticeable shape about it. This is notice that the asterisk in the top corner, this is one of those things that most people don't really care about. Type designers, if you're designing layout for advertising copy or things like that, you definitely want to pay attention to this. When you're writing to Aunt Millie, Probably not so much. Some more rules, only one space after a period. If you are doing feet and inches, use the foot and inch markers rather than smart quotes, which is what Microsoft Word will do for you, is correct it to smart quotes, and you really want to use the foot and inch markers. Multiplication symbol, don't use the letter X. As you can see on the screen, it actually follows the shape of the typeface design. So because I'm using Book Antiqua as my base font, that X that you see is the shape of the X in Book Antiqua. What you really want to use is Unicode 00D7, which is that straight multiplication symbol. You can get it by entering in Unicode 00D7 in Word. So you would type in D7 and then press Alt X, and it'll correct that to that particular Unicode. For division, a little bit more subtle that you don't probably really have to worry so much about it, but you shouldn't use the keyboard slash. There is a Unicode symbol for division, and there are lots of math symbols in Unicode in Cambria Math, which is included with Microsoft Windows. Copying and pasting text. So this is, if you look at that, there's something a little bit odd going on there. And it's in those words there, something odd. If you look at the median line of the blue text and compare it to the median line for the red text, it's different. Then if you start looking at the actual shape of the characters, like the T, you can see there's considerable differences. Or the E, you can see that the aperture on the red text is a lot wider than the aperture on the blue text. The G is completely different. In the red text, we have a binocular version of a G, and we have a monocular version of the G in the blue text. Turns out they're both the same point size. Remember when I talked about, you know, point sizes not being all that related to the actual text size? The blue text is Arial 11 point, and the red text is Calabria 11 point. This came about because somebody copied and pasted something from one document to another without thinking about the fact that they were bringing across font information as well as the actual text. So be careful when you're copying and pasting. You don't want to copy over formatting for things like typeface size and style. So your best to do paste special, unformatted text to make sure that you don't end up making mistakes like that. You can end up with missing fonts. So if you choose typeface that you found somewhere else on the internet or Type Foundry or something like that, and then you give the resulting document to somebody else and they don't have that typeface, you're going to end up with a font substitute on that other person's computer. The solution to that is to embed the fonts in your document if you can. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not going to get into legalities of what you can and can't embed. Look that up on your own. But here's an example of it. So I have the font Cotton Candies that I downloaded from dafont.com, and you can see an example of some text in that. So if I took that document, I saved it, and I sent it to somebody who didn't have Cotton Candies installed on their computer, it still is identified as being Cotton Candies, but it obviously is not Cotton Candies font. And in actual fact, it did a substitute to Calibri as the typeface. So to get around that, in Microsoft Office, you go to File Options, and then in that one, you go to the Save section, and there's a checkbox for Embed Fonts in the File. And you can do it for either the current document or all new documents that will embed it. It will make your documents larger, but it means that the fidelity will be retained if you pass that on to somebody who doesn't have that particular font installed on their computer. It's not like they can then install it and use it in other documents and so forth, but it allows that one document to preserve the font. In LibreOffice Writer, you go to File Properties, and on the Font tab, there's options there for embedding the fonts in the document. And occasionally, you might run into this. Fonts can actually have restrictions built into them that say you can't embed the fonts. In this one, I took a font called Snowy Christmas, which was free for personal use, but it wouldn't let me actually save a document with that font in there, just license restriction on the font itself.
Chris, Tom's yep. asking, if you save as PDF, does that save the fonts?
I do not know. I believe it does. I'd have to test that. Really not sure. If we look at anatomy of a newsletter, so we look at the Ottawa PC News, and we just analyze this. So we've got two typefaces that are used, Arial and Times New Roman. And we have a number of different styles, bold, italic, or bold, italic. We have either two or three columns. And when it's two column, it varies between an even split or one-third and two-third split, depending on the content on a particular page. We have ragged right justification. We have some enhancements. The article header stands out because it's a line there with white on blue. Every article starts off with a three-line drop cap. Subheads are bolded bolded in the same typeface as the body. We have at the bottom, we have the index, black on blue, and the next meeting, black on blue, to make those things, elements stand out. In addition to that, the logo is Bengat Book Italic for the word Ottawa, and Bengat Bold for PC News. So quite an attractive layout for it, and things stand out that need to stand out in the newsletter. So quite effective use of different typography features. Some fonts have been optimized for size, and Sitka is one of them that's included with Windows, and they actually have separate font files for Sitka Small through Sitka Banner, and they're actually optimized to be used at different point sizes. So kind of neat. There's a document that I linked there that talks about the design of Sitka and how it was a collaboration between design and science. Quite an interesting article. Most widely used font in the world is Calibri. And why? Well, it was designed in 2002 by Lucas de Groot for Microsoft, and in 2007 it became the default for Word, which replaced Times New Roman, and for Outlook, PowerPoint, and Excel, where the default had been Arial. So as Simon Garfield in the book Just My Type, he said, but does this make this the best font, most versatile, most seductive, surprising, and beautiful? And he answered his questions, of course not. That font is yet to come. And speaking about yet to come, Microsoft's next default font. So Microsoft has actually commissioned five new fonts. One of them is going to become the new default for Microsoft Office applications. Tenorite is one of them. I'll just say I have to read one of these because this is the way typographers talk about typefaces. A warm, friendly style, large dots, accents, and punctuation make it comfortable to read at small sizes on screen. Crisp-looking shapes and wide characters create an open feeling. Yeah, this is the way they talk about things. Another one is Bierstadt. You know, it's versatile, it expresses simplicity and rationality, highly readable form. Clear cut with stroke endings that emphasize order and restraint. Yeah, I don't know. It's like people talk about wines. I don't understand that either. Skeena is another one. Seaford, another. And Grandview is the last of the five. And they've actually put that out for comment that anybody can weigh in to say what they think should be the next default font in Microsoft Office applications. So some resources. Some books that I've read on typography. I think if you had to read only one, this is probably the best, Just My Type, by Simon Garfield. Really, really good book. It really goes into a lot of, it's back and forth all over the place, talking about history of fonts and uses and things like that. It's really quite a good book. This one I really like. This was the first book I ever read on typography, Stop Stealing Sheep and Find Out How Type Works, by Eric Speakerman, that German typographer. And the title of it, Stop Stealing Sheep, it's an interesting tale. It comes from the fact that Frederick Gaudy, who was a designer, type designer in the early 1900s, he was being awarded for something about typography, and he was handed this certificate that had been lovingly put together in black letter. And he looked at it and he said, anyone who had letter space black letter would steal sheep. And the story is that he didn't actually use the word steal. He used another word there. Most of the more polite areas, they use the word steal. So that's where the title comes from, is how you avoid stealing sheep. It is unfortunately out of print, but you can get 30 pages of the book for free. from the URL that I give there. If you can find that book in a used bookstore or something like that, it's quite a good book. I don't recommend it as your first book on typography. After you've read one or two other ones, this one makes a lot more sense. So I found that this actually helped me an awful lot once I read some other things. But it's a very, very well-constructed book. The anatomy type I like because it actually gives you these big, huge looks at 100 different typefaces, and they talk about the characteristics and what makes one different, more suitable for the other, for one purpose over another. It gives a little bit of history and things like that. I really like that book. Designing with Type is more like a textbook than anything else, I find. But it does go sort of methodically through looking at history of them, how to design pages with particular typefaces and so forth. I thought it was quite good. This one I found really good if you're into looking at trying to categorize typefaces. So this really goes into the categories and the subcategories, and they analyze what it is that makes a certain typeface fit one category versus the other. Other than that, it's a little bit boring. There's only been one movie, or one typeface that was actually made into a movie, Helvetica. So I love they bought Banner for this. You know, meet the cast, and they have A to Z. Now see the movie Helvetica. I can't find that for free anywhere, but I don't know if I want to pay the $30 or something like that. They want to charge me to actually watch it. So Microsoft has a lot of information on typography. They have the Windows 10 font list, which is really, really good. It includes, in some cases, the history of the particular typeface, usage guidelines, pairing information, things like that in there. They also have that font redistribution FAQ. If you're interested in legal stuff about whether you can embed fonts or where you can and can't use the fonts that are included with Windows.
Chris, yep. There's a question from Karen. She says there's so many fonts. Is there a document or a resource that groups fonts in categories to help select a font to use? Would that Microsoft one be something like that?
In some cases, yes. There's some of the other resources that I'm going to be listing that probably would be more appropriate for that. So I'll try and hit on them as I go through. I'm going to flash through most of these other ones. So I like these three on this page just give a lot of information about typefaces and how-tos and stuff like that. The Thinking with Type might have some information along that lines. This a little bit more so about combining things, digital design, information on typography. If you're interested in more typographical terms, the Learning Hub is very good on that. The visual guide to anatomy of typography I found to be quite good, a lot of information. If you want to know anything about monotype fonts, myfonts.com has all of the information. It's owned by Monotype and has all the information about history, pairings, characteristics, categories, things like that for monotype fonts. If you come across a font and you want to know what the font is, there's two resources I found, What the Font and What Font Is. In the What the Font, they actually have an app for either Android or iOS that you can actually just point your camera in your phone, add a particular font, take a picture of it, and it will try to identify the particular typeface. The websites for both of those, you can basically just take a screenshot, upload the graphic, and they will try to identify the typeface from the graphic that you upload. 10 font characteristics and their use in design. That might be along the lines of Karen was talking. I have some stuff on that. Understanding the nuances of classification would definitely have information along that lines. If you're trying to pair typefaces, FontJoy and Canva are two resources that claim to do it. As I said, I don't understand pairing of fonts and why, you know, Arial works well with Candera. Doesn't make sense to me one way or the other, but they have some information there. Page design, if you want to look beyond just typefaces, but you're looking at the overall page layout, there's a couple of resources there that can help you out. If you want free fonts, Google Fonts has over 1,000 free open source typefaces. And if you're a website designer, they actually give you the code to embed on your web page so that will actually show your font to everybody who visits your website correctly. You can also download and install them on your computer. It's not just for website use. And they do have a lot of the fonts that are there. They have advice on pairing as well. And then there's defont.com, which has over 58,000 typefaces. Not all of them are free. And I find that there is a mixed quality, but there's a lot of ones on there that I find are quite good. There's lots of other websites as well. If you want to make or edit fonts, you know, here's a number of resources that are available to you. Free and open source, they have for Windows, Linux, and Mac OS. So there's three of them there that you can try out. And if you want free but they're not open source, there's four that I have listed there, the last two of which will allow you to actually convert your handwriting into a font. So the Calligrapher, you actually have to use a scanner for it. The Microsoft Font Maker, you actually have to use a pen-enabled device and draw your fonts on screen, and they will turn it into a font for you. And that's all, folks. Now, there's the URL for the deck. So if you want to pick up the entire deck, I have a whole bunch of more slides that are in here as well that are in the printed version. I don't have time. I'm running at 9 o'clock right now, so I don't have time to cover any of them now. But they have information on how you can examine typefaces in Windows, a number of different ways, how to install typefaces in Windows, either for the current user or all users, how to uninstall typefaces, information about things like ligatures and how you can use ligatures to make your text more elegant, perhaps more readable, things like that. So there's a lot of extra stuff that I have in the other slides, just going through, you know, different obliques and fake obliques, ligature information, ligatures and tracking, information on that, different things on some other stylistic sets, how to examine fonts, how to install fonts, how to uninstall fonts, and then what I think is one of the worst examples of typography. I'll just go over this. Vengeance Van is actually a commercial enterprise. They'll actually drive around to your house and let you bash the hell out of, you know, a car or TVs or whatever you're willing to pay for. And their entire website uses the font that you see on screen there. I just can't believe it. You can actually go to vengeancevan.com and see for yourself. I can't believe that they actually use that. Anyhow, with that, I am done, so that's all, folks, really. And again, there's the deck. If there are any questions, we can take a couple now, and then we will break for a few minutes and then start up the Q&A. So do we have any other questions?
There were, but there's some really excellent thank yous. You can read them later on, but one says, thanks for expanding my universe yet again. And what I really like is, you can, this is Dennis, you very can bring to life a topic I did not know could be so vivacious. What will your next presentation be? A reading, a soliloquy of the telephone book. Count me in.
Thank you.
So on behalf of the group, thanks very much, Chris. That was truly excellent.
Thank you. Okay, with that, I will stop the a share on that, and what I'm going to do is start a share on something else. So let me there, and oops, yeah, okay. Okay, so let's take a 5-minute break, and let me just if I can find it. Where is my controls? Mm-hmm. Okay, so if I do a share screen and share that. So we are having Q&A come up. So in 4 minutes, 40 seconds, we are going to start with Q&A. And the agenda that we have on so far is on the screen. And so if everybody just wanted to grab a cup of coffee or take a break or whatever, I'm happy to stick around and take any questions during this break if anybody has anything else that they want to bring up. And what I will do is I'm going to do the mute all with the second. I can't unmute everybody, but what I can do is mute all and allow you to unmute yourself. So if anybody wants to unmute their microphone, they could do so now or throw it into the chat window, And for the next 4 minutes, I'm happy to take any other questions people have about typography.
Hi, Chris.
Yep.
Yes, I have a question about the, I believe it's in the last, the one before last slide where you show the different programs that can be used to convert your handwriting into, and was there a freeware there or something on the cheaper side?
All of the ones that I listed are free. So the top three, I guess it was, were free and open source. The bottom four are free, but they're not open source. So some people care about open source. Most people probably don't because you don't really want to compile your own version of the program. But all of them are 100% free of charge.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, I guess we have no other questions, so we'll just wait out the 2.5 minutes, and then we'll start up with Q&A.
Okay, I've got a question for you about sans serif fonts.
Yep.
I find some of them really bad, and especially something like Arial, because I can never tell the difference between a lowercase L and the number one.
Yeah.
And that's a real pain when you in certain situations.
I mean, there's again, appropriate and inappropriate uses of just about every typeface. And certainly that idea of legibility, where you can distinguish one character from another, if you have a lot of that going on, then that's a real problem. Or it can be a real problem. Now, sometimes context will give it to you. You know, so if you – I have an upcoming article for the newsletter on this problem of being used to trick people to go to websites that they think they're going to one place and they're actually going to another because of things like, an uppercase I looking the same as a lowercase L and things like that. It can be a problem. And so you just have to identify that in a particular typeface that if you don't want to run into that, then, yeah, choose another typeface. There's lots to be that are available. But there are good and bad typefaces in serifs and sans serifs, undoubtedly.
Could you put the link for the presentation in the chat window?
Yeah.
I can't seem to dig it up here.
Yeah, okay. Alan, did you have that handy? Or
I'm sorry.
Okay, then no problem.
If
I can get it.
Just go back.
No problem. No problem. Okay. I got it. And thanks. I will paste it into the chat.
I have a question.
Yep.
I'm looking for a program that can print typeface in a different language, in Thai language. And so far, I cannot find that. I want sample pages of text in different fonts in Thai language.
It depends on the typeface whether the type designer bothered to include foreign languages, and it's hit and miss. And I did paste in the Tom sent directly to me, so let me just do this again. So there be is a link to the
Thank
presentation.
You.
So it's hit and miss with different typefaces. If you're going to a type foundry like Monotype or something like that, they will usually let you know all of the glyphs that are available. Other than that, it's just a matter of going in and examining each font until you find one that includes the glyphs that you're interested in. In the deck, I do have the way of examining different typefaces, so you can look at all of the glyphs that are in a particular typeface. Other than that, I'm not sure. Other way you'd find them.
I use a font lister, and it shows me the Western characters in that particular font, and then the ones from Thai at the bottom.
Yeah.
Now, when I try to print a sample page, it goes to default the Western characters.
Yeah, generally will default to that. I'm not sure. In a lot of cases, I don't know how you particularly call upon a subset of the characters within that typeface. I'm really not sure what the answer is to that. You don't want to be able to or have to go in with, you know, picking out character by character or anything like that. You would think that they would tie into something like the keyboard that you're using, but I guess they're not doing that.
No, because I switch from French to English to Thai all the time.
Yeah, and, not sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Tom asked me, is there a way to search by language for fonts? And that, I presume, Tom, you're looking for a font that supports a particular language in an alternate character set or something like that. I don't know of a way to search for that. Okay, he says Thai. Yeah, I'm not sure how you would be able to search within fonts for particular character sets. Sorry, I'm at a loss on that one. Okay, we are at the end of the break, so we got quite a bit of stuff to cover off in the Q&A. So I'm going to stop that share, and I'm going to kick it off with...
Can you switch the recording?
Oh, yeah, sorry. Yeah, you're right. Okay, so I'm going to stop the recording.